welcome to this episode of Explore Cell Therapy. In this podcast, we explore practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies through conversations with transplant centers and hematology oncology practices. I'm Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. For this episode, I sat down with Dr. Fred Applebaum of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center and Dr. Courtney Belomo of New York Oncology Hematology to discuss the evolution of transplant over time. We explore how clinical practice is constantly changing in this rapidly evolving field, and how transplant centers and hematology oncology practices can work together to close gaps in provider understanding that ultimately lead to gaps in patient access to potentially life-saving treatment options. To read their full bios and access additional resources related to today's episode, follow the link in the episode description. This is part two of a three-part discussion.
The other thing we're starting to talk about, Sam, access was donor availability, which is that's something that has changed, you know, from when I started hugely. As I was saying, the only transplants we did were identical twins and matched siblings, and that limited transplantation to less than a third of the patients in need. We did the first unrelated donor transplant for leukemia back in 78. The story of that, if you want a real quick story about that.
Would love to hear it, yes.
So, John Hansen, who is one of my colleagues here, was sitting in his office, and there was a knock on the door, and he looks up, and there's this big guy wearing a cowboy hat with a satchel filled with records and a sort of a rolled up chart. And he says, excuse me, he hadn't called ahead. That wasn't his style, just knocked on the door and said, excuse me, Dr. Hansen, my name is Bob Graves. I have a little girl with leukemia and I need to talk to you. And John said, come on in. And Bob was owned a ranch in Colorado, which was a dairy ranch, but he was also a veterinarian and knew enough about medicine that he had read everything there was. And he had a daughter, Laura Graves, who was a 10-year-old who had acute lymphocytic leukemia, had failed first-line therapy, and was going to die if she didn't get a transplant, but none of her siblings matched her. Bob rolled out the sheet showing the HLA type, and based on the inheritance, you could tell that she had two of the most common haplotypes that exist. Bob just showed, based on the parental typing and her typing, what the haplotypes had to be. And he said to John, he said, you know, I know that she doesn't have a matched sibling, but these haplotypes are so common, I'll bet you could find an unrelated donor if you looked. And John said, well, maybe, but it's not up to me. We got to go talk to Don Thomas. And so they walked downstairs to Don's office, knocked on Don's door and said, can you talk to us for a minute? And Don heard Bob's spiel. And he looked at John and said, well, we've not done it. Do you think typing is advanced enough that we could possibly do this? And John said, I think so. So they said, okay, we'll consider it. And so Bob Graves goes home, and that's the information he needed. And John was doing HLA studies. And so he had a little file. And when I say a file, I don't mean a computer file. I mean a little box with paper cards in it, you know, those old 3x5 file cards with the HLA typing and
recipe box.
Exactly. And he's looking through it. And sure enough, one of our technicians who had volunteered to give blood for HLA studies, not to be a donor, matched Laura Graves. And so we went and talked to the donor, and she was willing. We called Bob Graves back and said, do you really want to do this? They did. And so Laura came and got a transplant. The transplant went as smoothly as you can imagine. She spent 50 days in an LAF room, not because she needed to. She never had a fever, never had GVHD, but just precaution. And she survived the transplant. Unfortunately, her leukemia came back and she died about 2 years after the transplant. But Bob was so taken by this, and he and his wife started getting calls from other parents, you know, how did you do this? And so Bob said, you know, we have to figure out a way to solve this problem. I don't want to make the story too long, but a second thing happened about near the same time as I got referred a patient from a friend of mine at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, and his name was Elmo Zumwalt III, who was the son of Elmo Zumwalt, who was the head of naval operations in the Pacific during the Vietnam War. The story is sort of poignant because his son developed an unusual leukemia lymphoma after being a PT boat captain in Vietnam because he had been heavily exposed to Agent Orange, which his father had ordered for defoliation. And there's a book called My Father, My Son, which talks all about this. It's an incredible story. But anyway, Elmo, the admiral, met Don Thomas and asked what could he possibly do to help. And the admiral and Bob Graves and Don Thomas got together, and together they were able to get money from the Navy to help form what turned out to be the NMDP, the initial NMDP. And that's right. Kind of how it all came together.
That's amazing.
That was the first unrelated donor transplant. And of course, what happened then is the NMDP story. They did an incredible job of growing their program and going from no donors to 1,000 to 10,000 and then 100,000. And now worldwide, 40 million is just incredible. I mean, it is just incredible. You know, a lot of us, including people at the Hutch, thought that it was undoable. We really had a lot of speculation about whether it was really possible that you could get people to, at the time, remember, we weren't doing peripheral blood. This was bone marrow. This is people undergoing general anesthesia, a week of real discomfort for someone that they didn't know, just out of the goodness of their hearts. And there's lots of terrible things that happen in the world, for sure. We all know that and more, but there's also a lot of good in the world and a lot of really altruistic people. And I don't think anything points that out more than the NMDP, frankly.
No, absolutely. Our donors are absolutely amazing, and they really care. And they really want to make a difference and help someone if they can. So it's truly remarkable and amazing to be a part of, honestly. Yes.
And now with the unrelated donors, and as Courtney was saying earlier, with cords and with haplos, we've gone from a situation where we 2/3 of the time we said, I'm sorry, we can't help you, now we can find a donor for the vast majority of people in need. That's really an incredible advance.
No, and it's amazing to, you know, and I'm sure you feel this way as well, Dr. Applebaum, but it's always, to me, so amazing to see, one, the resilience of people, but two, the way people find each other and connect, right? So when I was out at the City of Hope doing this kind of month, really enjoyment of my brother in Los Angeles. But when I was out there, they had, which we didn't do at my institution, this huge picnic, about transplant
reunion,
but reunion where people met. People met their donor.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever cried so hard in public where people could see me watching these people meet their donors and what that kind of small impact has. You know, you swab your cheek and then you can save someone's life. And amazing how that works. We had, where I trained, we had two people who ended up, donor and patient ended up, they ended up not getting married, but ended up engaged. They had like a whole thing on the Oprah special because they met that way as they donated to one another. And it was always like a big thing that they talked about when I was training. I remember hearing my mentor talk about that, but how people kind of forge this connection and the concept of what it really means to pay it forward. Because I think so many people that go into the NMDP or because they have a personal history of a family member that needed it, or they heard about it, that they needed it. And it's not a big deal to get your cheek swabbed and potentially sit somewhere and wait for, you know, kind of your name to be called, if you will. But what that, you know, it would be nice to, I think, hear that messaging on the news right now as we hear everything, right, about how people show up for one another.
Absolutely. And, you know, early on when we were trying to form these registries, there was only a limited amount of money available that came from the initial grants from the Navy. That helped an awful lot, but HLA typing is expensive and somebody had to pay for it. And so there are also some families that that deserve an awful lot of credit that they themselves developed their own donor drives. And so they would have people come and pay, you know, a couple hundred bucks to get HLA typed to put their name in the registry, or they get donations from the church or their synagogue. I think the Friends of Allison Atlas got 70,000 people to be typed over the years to add to the registry. So there's just all these different people that have contributed that are the unsung heroes that have made this possible. So I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, and especially I think when I first started, so I started at NYOH in 2013. And when I first started, we would HLA type them, but really for HLA match platelets if they needed them. Because we didn't do the kind of, you know, more expensive, more deep dive ours was very superficial and not really what you needed to do a transplant. And I remember time and time again, how many patients, how many family members wanted to just find out were they a match or not. And our answer was, look, your insurance company is only going to pay for it once. So we can't do it. We have to wait till you get to the transplant center. And now with HLA Today and HLA Family, we can actually tell them right up front and they can start to prepare for what that looks like. It's the program through the NMDP, I think, has made a big difference how at a community level we can engage with them about transplant.
Yeah,
so that when they come to you, they're prepared to have a real conversation.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's pretty amazing that I can press a button and within minutes access 40 million HLA typing through the sharing of information. And I can tell a patient, you know, hey, you got, you have 100 donors and 10 of them have already been high resolution typing. So it's not going to be a problem whatsoever finding you a donor in a short order. Or alternatively, I can tell them, you know, you got a rare HLA type. We're probably going to have to start looking for your kids or your parents or a cord because, unfortunately, HLA is so incredibly variable. They're just, you're unique in the world, which a lot of people are, as it turns out.
And that sort of brings up an interesting question about advances in mismatch unrelated donor transplant. Dr. Applebaum, I'm curious, how has what's Hutch's sort of standard protocol around permissible mismatches, for those who don't have a perfect match on the registry, let's say?
That's a great question, Sam. We have an algorithm, an order in which we go from matched sibling to 10 of 10 matched unrelated. And then we go down the list depending on the age and the disease and relapse risk. And so if there's a high relapse risk, we, at our center, we tend to favor cords over haplos for patients that have high risk because we see a better graft versus leukemia effect with cords. But if you were Hopkins, you would be doing haplos over identical twins, but that's how Rick Jones views the world, and God bless him. They were incredible contributors in making haploidentical transplants more feasible. So each center has their own algorithm that they use. Fortunately, we are blessed to have Effie Petersdorf as one of our senior scientists who's devoted her life to HLA and typing and outcomes based on donor types. And Filippo Milano, you know, we had the article in the New England Journal about the GVL effect of cord blood in patients that went into a transplant with minimal residual disease. And so each center has their own algorithms that's based on both their own personal expertise and experience, as well as what's published in the literature. And I want to be clear that it's not right or wrong that centers develop unique expertise. And in some of the trials where we've compared, for example, cord blood versus haplo, the outcomes look not too different. But if you went center by center, the centers that had lots of experience with cord blood, the outcomes were better with cords. The centers that had lots of experience with haplos, outcomes are better with haplos. There is something called the practice of medicine, and it is a practice. It's a very complicated procedure. Humans are incredibly complex. The diseases are complex. And these, you know, I think this is just the reality of a very difficult procedure that has so many different parts to it.
Thanks so much for continuing to join us for this exploration of advances in transplantation. Join us next time on Explore Cell Therapy for the final part of this discussion.